ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
G'day, welcome to PM. I'm David Lipson, coming to you from Gadigal Land in Sydney. Tonight, an historic address to Parliament by PNG's leader as the battle for strategic influence in the Indo-Pacific ramps up. Also, profits soar at one of the country's biggest energy providers at a time of painful power bills for consumers. And it's just not cricket. Why is the game of Yorkers, Googlies and silly mid-on trying to find a new home in the United States of America?
A crack off the bat and it disappears a mile.
You know, there's huge growth possibilities in the US. I just think it's got potential to become huge and I want to be a part of that journey along the way.
Thanks for your company. There are good reasons Australia provides more aid to Papua New Guinea than any other nation. Our closest neighbour is beset by regular bouts of unrest and entrenched poverty. And there's a deep history and genuine friendship as well. But PNG is also hugely important for Australia in a strategic sense, as the quiet battle against China for influence in the Indo-Pacific rages on. As such, today's historic address to Parliament by PNG's leader James Marape was particularly significant, the first such address by any Pacific leader. Prime Minister Marape, who's facing a looming vote of no confidence at home, urged Australia not to give up hope for his country's future, while Anthony Albanese stated he wanted Australia to remain PNG's primary partner. Here's our PNG correspondent, Tim Swanston.
Arriving outside Parliament, PNG Prime Minister James Marape was welcomed with a traditional artillery salute. He was greeted by Anthony Albanese and other dignitaries. The anthems were played, and then inside, the formalities continued.
Mr. Prime Minister, I welcome you to the House of Representatives chamber.
The invite was extended to PNG's Prime Minister after Prime Minister Albanese's own address to PNG's Parliament last year. Welcoming Mr. Marape to the chamber, Mr. Albanese spoke about a new era of cooperation between the two countries.
It will be a decisive decade for us, and it can be a decisive decade because of us, because of what we decide together.
The key theme of Mr. Marape's speech was to thank Australia for the mutual transition into independence in 1975.
It was from this Parliament that many decisions were made that have helped and shaped what Papua New Guinea was before 1975 and what Papua New Guinea is after 1975. This is why Papua New Guinea has a very special and very unique relationship with Australia.
This visit comes less than a month after deadly riots rocked PNG's capital of Port Moresby and several provincial centres. A commission of inquiry is being set up to look into the involvement of PNG police in the riots and how to improve the country's security forces. Opposition MPs have repeatedly blamed the violence on the poor standards of living for many in PNG. Mr. Marape acknowledged the need for greater empowerment of his citizens and issued a strong plea to Australia to stick by their side.
As I visit you today, I ask you, do not give up on Papua New Guinea. We have always bounced back from our low moments, and we will continue to grow, learning from every low moments and every high moments.
PNG relies on considerable financial support from Australia, some $1.2 billion since 2019, and Mr. Marape spoke about the need to expand his country's economic base.
We must become a strong country, standing on our 2 feet, economically independent and strong, so we too can help Australia maintain democracy, preserve peace and ensure stability in our part of planet Earth, in our Pacific.
Following the speech, Mr Albanese and Mr Marape held joint talks, of which security was a key feature. The two nations are still working out the finer details of $200 million in Australian spending that accompanied a bilateral security agreement signed in December. The pair also discussed expanding the Pacific Australia Labour Mobility Scheme and moves to make visa processes smoother for Papua New Guineans visiting Australia. Mr Marape returns to PNG tomorrow and the country's parliament resumes next week. It'll be a fraught time, with a no-confidence motion grace period expiring, and the PM could face a test of his leadership as early as Tuesday. This is Tim Swanston in Port Moresby reporting for PM.
Millions of low and middle income Australian households are struggling to pay soaring power bills. So hearing that one of the big companies supplying that power is raking in big profits may be hard to swallow. Today, AGL Energy posted a first half underlying profit after tax of $399 million. That's up 359% on the same period last year. It achieved the bumper profit through higher prices for consumers. So is this fair? And is there any energy price relief for households on the horizon? Here's David Taylor.
A huge surge in AGL's profit was cheered by the stock market, the share price up around 10%.
Yes, it definitely is quite something.
Alison Reeve is the Deputy Program Director of Energy and Climate Change at the Grattan Institute. She says the past couple of years have been rough for the energy giant, weighed down by ageing power plants and a messy takeover approach from billionaire Mike Cannon-Brookes.
If you look at the long-term trend on AGL's share price, it has been sort of gradually falling for a long time because there was a lot of uncertainty around takeover offer from Mike Cannon-Brookes, whether or not the company was going to be split up and what their future direction was.
She says investors seem to be encouraged by the prospect of more profits later in the year.
And I think that's because the same factors that have led to this increase in profit are probably going to persist for the second half of the year as well.
Those factors include lower costs and higher prices for AGL. Tim Buckley is the director of think tank Climate Energy Finance. He says AGL is in a sweet spot. The cost of supplying electricity to households has plummeted, but the company has kept its prices elevated.
They've seen wholesale costs coming down and in return retail prices held up. But that's also a function of the regulated protections that are in place under the Australian Energy Regulator, that we have a little bit of a lagged impact on the retail pricing. It's done annually on a fiscal year. So come the 1st of July 2024, we'll have a different profile than what we've had for the last 2 years, which is hyper electricity price inflation.
So the regulator's price cap was there to protect consumers when the wholesale price was very, very high. But what you're saying is the wholesale price has come down a lot, but the price cap hasn't moved.
The price cap is the default market offer is the terminology. So the regulator sets the default market offer and it's a lagged impact.
Really briefly, the government brought in what's called the default market offer to ensure households could keep the lights on, even with a soaring wholesale cost of electricity. It acted like a cap on electricity prices, stopping electricity retailers from price gouging customers. The wholesale electricity price has since halved, but households are still being slugged with big power bills because retail prices haven't come down by the same amount.
What we've seen with this here is that they've been selling energy to customers at, you know, higher prices that were partly reflected by the default market offer, but also charging what the market will bear. And they kind of got lucky in that what they had to buy the energy at turned out to be at a much lower cost than what they thought. Now, what happens with customers in the future very much depends on the contracts that they wrote last year and the contracts that they write this year and the contracts that they write next year.
Indeed, Alison Reeve says there are plenty of options for customers who don't mind if their bills skyrocket one day and plummet the next.
You know, there are also retail options for people who want to be exposed to the vagaries of the wholesale price and are happy to sort of to kind of play that roulette game of, you know, lapping up the lower prices when they are there, but, you know, also taking it on on the downside when the prices are high.
AGL Energy rejects any suggestion it's overcharging customers. CEO Damien Nix says, quote, "We are acutely aware of the cost of living pressures both our customers and the broader community is under," adding, "We operate in a highly regulated environment and one of the most competitive markets around." While the wholesale cost of electricity has halved over the past 12 months, the CEO today insisted it was too early to comment on the pricing outlook for this coming financial year. And the regulator told PM, without a cap on standing offer prices, retailers could be charging even more than they are today.
David Taylor. After months of negotiations with the Greens and crossbench MPs and senators, the federal government's latest tranche of industrial relations reforms has just passed the Senate. They are set to become law after an effective rubber stamp in the House of Representatives. They include changes to the definition of a casual employee, greater protection for gig workers, and a right to disconnect from work when you're not being paid. The peak body for small business says the new laws will be costly, though, and complex for its members. So will those costs be passed on? Here's Samantha Donovan.
After agreeing to many amendments in return for the support of the Greens and crossbench MPs, the Minister for Employment and Workplace Relations, Tony Burke, was spruiking the government's latest IR laws.
A majority of senators have declared support to pass the Closing Loopholes Bill number 2 today. I want to thank the Australian Greens for the negotiations that have happened there. I want to thank Senator Lydia Thorpe, who's been strong in backing working people. I want to thank Senator David Pocock for the work that he's done in working through amendments. And while Senator Lambie, we didn't end up reaching agreement on the bill as a whole, there will be some amendments, not all of Senator Lambie's amendments, but some that were negotiated and agreed amongst all of those who are part of the negotiations that we'll be supporting in good faith.
He says the new laws will benefit some Australians in particular.
Today is a good day for casuals, a good day for gig workers, a good day for truck drivers and people in road transport, and a good day for those workers who want to be able to know that when they're on their weekend and not being paid, they can enjoy their weekend.
The opposition leader, Peter Dutton, condemned the government's IR laws on Sydney radio station 2GB.
This is payday for the unions. The unions decided, the leadership within the Labor Party, and that's why Anthony Albanese is the leader of the Labor Party. And when the union bosses turn up to the Prime Minister's office with a list of demands and the laws that they want changed, the Prime Minister and the Minister jump into action.
The Council of Small Business Organisations Australia, or COSBOA, regards the IR changes as significant and complex. Luke Achterstrat is its CEO.
You know, this was a six-month process with an omnibus bill which pretty much touches every piece of the economy. There were significant changes the government was trying to make around the use of casual workers and independent contractors. And the sheer red tape and complexity of what the government was pursuing was of extreme concern to small business and to COSBOA.
He credits Senators David Pocock and Jackie Lambie for keeping small business in mind and convincing the government to make changes on issues like compliance costs and the hiring of casuals. But he says the new laws will lead to higher costs and more red tape for employers.
So small businesses don't typically have specialised in-house human resources support. So this is an important point. Every time the government makes complex changes, redefines things, changes concepts, there's a really disproportionate impact and cost on small business. Small business will need to potentially go to market, get advice, take time away from their business to actually understand what's being proposed. Also, union right of entry onto work sites was also another concerning part for small business.
He doesn't think the new IR laws will benefit the broader economy.
Look, we don't see this assisting cost of living. We don't see this assisting productivity. There was no emphasis on the words productivity at all in the 800-page bill. There's no emphasis on making life easier for small business to actually hire people. So we've got a productivity problem in Australia. The intergenerational report actually has downwardly revised productivity growth from 1.5 to 1.2% over the next 40 years. So it's going to be the future generations that pay that bill of reduced living standards if we can't turn productivity around.
The National Secretary of the United Workers Union, Tim Kennedy, believes the new laws will change the lives of casual workers.
Well, what we have in Australia at the moment is we're talking about a cost of living crisis, but we actually have a fundamental break with the social contract with the younger generation in this country, where they don't actually have the rights that many of us grew up with. That is, if you work in a permanent full-time situation, you should have the protections that come with that. And so when you have a predominance of casual work, especially for young people, they cannot get their life going. And I think there is an obligation on everyone, employers especially, that if you employ people as permanent full-time in the way they go about their work, it is not good enough to simply exploit them by saying you're casual.
The National Farmers Federation's chief executive, Tony Maher, has criticised the new IR laws and said his members' concerns haven't been listened to. He said the changes to the definition of casual employment discourage job creation in the farm sector, and he's accused the government of scrabbling together last-minute backroom deals without proper debate and scrutiny.
Samantha Donovan there. You are listening to PM. I'm David Lipson. Coming up, have you had problems with your telco provider? You're not alone. New stats show a jump in complaints. The crocodile population in the Northern Territory has exploded. 50 years ago, the estimated total was 3,000 wild crocs across the Top End. Today, it's 100,000. Fresh debate has erupted about whether the population should be culled since an attack at a popular tourist swimming spot last year. And the government now says its policies are up for review. Here's Jacqueline Breen.
Damien Duffy, who goes by Wildman to his mates, works the tourist cruisers on the Adelaide River just outside Darwin and says he has the best job in the world.
Far out. It's like going to Disneyland, mate. All I have to do out here is talk about crocodiles, drive boats, and enjoy the scenery.
On the cruises, chunks of chicken or buffalo meat are dangled over the boat's edge, and the crocs launch themselves straight up out of the water to grab a feed. He knows all of them by name.
Oh, we've got Knuckles, we've got Stumpy, we've got Walkeye, Blondie, Marilyn, Bondi as well. We've got Fluffy, we've got Slinky, Casanova up around the corner.
Crocodiles are one of the territory's top tourist draw cards, but they've been drawing closer in recent years to the major population centres in the Top End. Convat Scarless is Darwin Lord Mayor.
We had 3,000 and we stopped counting quite right at the time. Now we've got 100,000 that we know of, and there are many more we don't know of.
The population was decimated by hunting until it was banned in the early 70s. Since then, the population's well and truly recovered, and there's periodic debate about whether the numbers are too large. There were 3,000 crocs removed from the wild over the past 12 years. Now, the government's reviewing its management plan and asking whether greater culling needs to occur. This week, the Chief Minister, Eva Lawler, said she believes so, but also that she'll take the advice of experts. Darwin Lord Mayor Convat Scarless also says yes. He was a minister in a previous Territory Labor government and argued for more regulated hunting to be legalised.
But of course, people in Melbourne, they love the crocodiles because they live too far away from them. They don't have the risk we've got up here every day in a crocodile country. We have to control the population. We don't have to destroy the species. At the end of the day, it's a natural part of our ecosystem. But at the same time, it's something that can provide jobs and opportunities for indigenous communities. And we have to protect the public.
The expert consensus so far, though, is that the current management regime, which includes extensive monitoring and removal of problem crocs, is actually world class. Professor Sam Banks is a biodiversity expert from Charles Darwin University.
Any fatal attack is a serious tragedy, but we haven't had one since 2018. We've got more crocodiles than Queensland. We have fewer attacks than them. We've got a lot more crocodiles than Indonesia. They had 85 attacks last year. So if you put that in context, it's a program that's working very well.
He says croc numbers are reaching carrying capacity and will plateau. Damien Duffy, the tour guide, is also a passionate conservationist and says education for tourists and locals should be the focus.
The illusion that culling a few crocodiles will make it safe to go swimming in certain areas is, well, that's a really dangerous idea to put into people's heads. It doesn't matter how many crocodiles you take out of the environment, unless they're all gone, every single one of them, it'll be never safe to dip your toe in the water. This is natural crocodile habitat, and you've got to be a little bit smart about your behaviour around waterways.
The review will also look at ways to enhance the lucrative croc farming industry, and the government says it wants to increase Aboriginal involvement in it, and that the new plan will increase a focus on Indigenous traditions and rights. Nigel Brown is a Larrakia traditional owner from the Darwin region and says additional Aboriginal groups are interested in the right opportunities in the industry and must be closely consulted. Speaking on the side of a remote highway, he explains the Dungalaba, the crocodile, is a Larrakia totem like it is for many other coastal groups.
I think for Larrakia, it's one of, you know, mutual respect. We look to the Dungalaba as a source of strength and pride and something that has survived for millions of years. But we also respect their habits, their territory too. And it's one that we obviously have to share and coexist in, as like every other coastal group has had to do for tens of thousands of years.
That's the head of Darwin's Larrakia Development Corporation, Nigel Brown. Jacqueline Breen, our reporter. Well, we're all used to mobile black spots, but how would you cope if you didn't even have enough reception at home to take a phone call? New data shows an increase in the number of complaints to the Telecommunications Ombudsman between October and December last year. Complaints about no phone or internet service increased by 33%. Authorities say the Optus outage has had an impact on those numbers. Elizabeth Cramsey reports.
Jim Spargo lives at Samson Vale with his young family and two horses.
We have Index and we have Dexter, both retirees. They're a retiree racehorse and retiree police horse.
They moved to the area 40 kilometres northwest of Brisbane's CBD 8 years ago. And while they're very happy in the semi-rural environment, they've had to make some compromises, most notably phone signal.
With that one bar of phone reception that you get, where inside your house do you get reception?
Nowhere. So to use a mobile phone, we have to come out onto the into the front yard near the horse trough, or go climb up the hill. You're lucky, you're getting a voice call, but if you try to do a video or stream some data or download a file or watch a video, it just drops out.
The family are now using satellite internet from Starlink and they're impressed by the speeds, but it was a lengthy road to get here.
Well, we gave up on the copper line because it was just unusable. Before Starlink, we tried mobile broadband. When we were told when we moved in we'd be able to get ADSL, and then we were told, no, you're on pair gain, so that's not going to happen. So then NBN didn't help us at all. We were offered SkyMaster, the satellite service, which proved to be next to useless.
And they're paying a premium for the service.
Hardware cost up front was about $1,000 and $140 a month.
Roughly double what he thinks he'd be paying otherwise. And he's made several complaints.
Complained to Telstra, complained to Optus. Then I complained to the Ombudsman. Then I complained to my federal member, Mr Dutton, and basically, we're working on it, or the satellite's your solution for the area.
He's not alone. Cynthia Gerbert is the Telecommunications Ombudsman.
We did see about a 13.5% increase in complaints compared to the previous quarter, positively, down nearly 18% on the same time last year. But, you know, the quarter that we're reporting on did include the mass outage on the 8th of November, which really highlighted for us how essential phone and internet services are to people's ability to do so many things that we just take for granted these days.
But not all the complaints were in relation to the outage.
We did see an increase in complaints about no phone or internet service. You know, some significant frustrations about delay in establishing a service. You know, customers think they've done everything they need to do to get their internet working and it's not working, as well as a few other issues around dropouts, you know, intermittent service and dropouts. So, you know, they're all things that speak to how much people rely on it, and they want it to work when they're ready for it to work. One of the good news stories, though, is that we did see nearly 10% decrease in complaints which relate to a telco not doing what it agreed.
So what about mobile phone coverage?
Mobile phone coverage is causing less issues, but it's not to say again that it's not frustrating. We did see some increase and, you know, it's annoying. You want it to work when you want it to work, and you don't want to have to only let be in the metro areas for it to be able to rely on your phone. We really encourage providers, telco providers, to be much clearer with people, particularly when they're selling products and services, about where it will work and where it won't work. And I think that's something we do need to keep focused on.
That's Telecommunications Ombudsman Cynthia Gebert ending that report from Elizabeth Cramsey. Have you ever tried explaining the game of cricket to an American? Well, it's hard enough, but how about trying to convince crowds of Americans to start supporting it? Well, that's what a T20 Major League Cricket competition, backed by big money in cities like New York, Seattle and San Francisco, is trying to do. Former Australian captain Ricky Ponting is even heading there to coach this year. So what are the chances that this time American sports lovers will fall in love with the sound of leather on willow? Isabel Masali prepared this report.
Pounded out of there! David Bissa with a monster!
Oh, that is a monster.
Wanting to get on top of him nice and early is Quinton de Kock.
A familiar sport with some familiar faces.
Washington Freedom are out of MLC.
But if you want to follow Major League Cricket in the United States, get used to some unusual team names. The San Francisco Unicorns, the Texas Super Kings, and last year's winners, MI New York. Now with the competition preparing to start its second season in July, it's hoped the Washington Freedom will get a boost from one of the game's legends. Former Australian captain Ricky Ponting is set to become head coach in DC.
Where I've got a feeling that this tournament can go is why I wanted to get involved, you know, as early as I have. Because I think there's huge potential, you know, there's huge growth possibilities in the US, you know, even with the IPL ownership, you know, model the way it is at the moment. I just think it's got potential to become huge, and I want to be a part of that journey along the way. So, yeah, we'll see what we can do to continue to grow the game in the US over the next couple of years.
It's clear there's plenty of optimism within the sport, but is it catching on with the public? We sent our Washington correspondent to ask locals what comes to mind when they hear the word cricket.
A guy with a stick, you know, players like spread out like a baseball formation, sort of, yeah.
Baseball. American baseball. Yeah, and the games go on like for hours and days.
Yeah, really long days.
Long games. Yeah. Like crazy points.
Yeah. And do you think you'd be able to explain the rules of cricket?
Absolutely not.
Do you think that if there's a big Australian star who's coaching a team here, mm-hmm. that would generate enough interest that Americans would properly get behind it? Or do you think it's still a bit like, maybe?
I don't know if that would be enough, just because I feel like that's probably happened in the past.
Jeff Lemon is a cricket writer, commentator and co-host of the Final Word podcast. He says while it may seem like a new sport for the US, that's far from the case.
Well, it's actually the longest history of international cricket of all. So the first international cricket match was played between the USA and Canada in 1844 in what is now Manhattan. So it was a long period of not much cricket going on in the US, but there was quite a substantial cricket scene through the 1800s. It declined through the 1900s. But it is starting to come back after advances made in the last couple of decades.
What's the reason for its resurgence now?
It's an interesting one. It's down to demographic shifts. You've got a lot of expats in America from the Caribbean, from India, from Pakistan, from Bangladesh. And so there's more of a cricket-loving populace than there might have been a couple of decades ago.
He doesn't think cricket will overtake the major sports, but says even a small US audience is an enticing and lucrative one.
They had a minor league cricket organisation going on for a couple of years before that as a test case. They've had a bunch of money put into some of the different teams by Silicon Valley billionaires and so on, who, you know, investors who are interested enough in cricket to want to try to get it up and running. And some of the teams in Major League Cricket in the US, this is the US domestic T20 league, also have links to some of the state cricket associations in Australia. So Cricket Victoria and Cricket New South Wales each have a link to one of the six teams in Major League Cricket.
There's also plenty of support, with the US and the West Indies set to host the ICC Men's T20 World Cup in June.
I mean, that requires a lot of money to be put in by the ICC, by the International Cricket Council. So the amount of money that they're needing to spend to build a temporary stadium for the New York City Games, so they're out on Long Island in an area of parkland, they're building from scratch a temporary stadium that'll take 30,000 plus people in an area that, you know, a couple of weeks ago was just an open grassy field. So there's a huge amount of money being spent on putting the tournament on in the USA with the hope that that will become worthwhile down the track.
As for where the players will come from, Jeff Lemon says they'll mostly be imported for now, but there's hope of more homegrown talent in the future.
And good luck to them, Isabel Musali, there with help from Phoebe Hosier in Washington. That is the program for today. Thanks for joining us here on PM. I'm David Lipson. Of course, we'll be back at the same time tomorrow. Until then, good night.
Hi, I'm Sam Hawley, host of the ABC News Daily podcast. Living in Australia, we know there's a lack of competition. Two big supermarkets, two big airlines, and just a few more banks and electricity providers. And we know because of that, well, we get ripped off. Today, investigative journalist Adele Ferguson on how big companies trick us into paying more and how we can stop them. Look for the ABC News Daily podcast on the ABC Listen app.